Velkommen til dagens utgave av Inside Israel her fra Internasjonale Kristne Ambassade i Jerusalem. Da det en glede å ønske deg velkommen til et av våre stormøter i løpet av året. Lørdag 28. mai klokken 2 samles vi i Kongeparken Amfi ved Stavanger. Dette er et av våre største arrangementer i løpet av året, hvor vi samler nærmere 4000 deltakere. I år kommer Jan Otto Johansen, Ben og Vera Karlsson fra Wien, Arvid Bensen, Leif Vellerop og Erik Selle. Lørdag 28. mai klokken 14.00 i Kongeparken Amfi ved Stavanger. Hjertelig velkommen. Ellers har vi også den årlige sommerkonferansen på Hedmarkstoppen i Hamar. Den går av stabelen fra torsdag 30. juni til søndag 3. juli. Dette er et arrangement for hele familien med tilrettelagt opplegg og program for barna, ungdommer og for de voksne deltakerne i arrangementet. Gå inn på internett icej.no. På vår webside der finner du mer informasjon om disse tingene og en lang rekke andre ting. 24. og 25. mars gikk Oslo Symposium av stabelen i Oslo Kongressenter. Internasjonale Kristne Ambassade i Jerusalem var vertskap for den delen av arrangementet som tok for seg Israel. Hovedtaler her var professor i juss ved Harvard Law School, Alan Dershowitz. Han er kjent som en av verdens fremste forsvarsadvokater. Han har vært advokat for O.J. Simpson, for Nelson Mandela, for Mike Tyson, og også nå utpekt som advokat for WikiLeaks Julian Assange. Dershowitz er også en internasjonal kapasitet når det gjelder Israel og Midtøsten. Han var blant rådgiverne når FN-resolusjon 242 ble forfattet. Vi tilbød Universitetet i Bergen, Oslo og Trondheim gratis forelesning med tema Israel og folkerett. Samtlige av universitetene takket nei. Endog sa dekan ved juridisk fakultet Asbjørn Strandbakken i Bergen at de var interessert i en forelesning med Dershowitz om tema strafferett og O.J. Simpson-saken. Forutsatt ikke et ord om Midtøsten. I motsetning til professorene og administrasjon så ønsket studentene Dershowitz velkommen. Og i regi av studentorganisasjoner og i regi av studenter så hadde vi fulle hus både i Bergen, i Oslo og i Trondheim med studenter hvor altså Dershowitz underviste om Israel og internasjonal lov. Du kan følge med på vår webside icej.no og se talene han holdt på disse universitetene. I tillegg skal du nå få se utdrag av den talen han holdt under Oslo Symposium. Hele den talen kan du også se på vår webside. Følg med.
Thank you. Thank you so much. What a wonderful event this is. What an incredible group who is sponsoring this event. They have treated me so warmly, so wonderfully. They have really made me feel at home in a country that has been somewhat cool to me in other respects. But this organization has been as warm as anybody could possibly be. The friendship that we mutually feel for each other and for Norway, for Israel, for democratic values, for Judeo-Christian values, for Abrahamic values, for all the values that I think join us together in this room are so evident in the warm feelings here today. I've been asked to speak here about several subjects. I want to start by talking about the substance of the issues that are involved in the Middle East conflict. I want to talk particularly about international law as it relates to the Middle East. If the translator thinks I'm going too fast, please let me know and I will slow down. I come from Brooklyn where we talk very, very, very fast. And so I appreciate if you'll let me know if I'm going too fast. Let me first start to talk about international law. Then I would like to talk about the role of Norway in the peace process involving the Middle East and a range of other subjects. International law, what is international law? It's very, very different from domestic law. Everybody knows what the sources of Norwegian law are. You have a parliament, you elect your parliament, you have a fair system of representation. If you don't like the law, you elect other parliamentarians, they can change it. You are bound by the law of Norway through a social contract. You have agreed to be citizens, the Norwegian government has agreed to protect you, and you have agreed to comply with the law. This goes back to the earliest times of democratic theory. What is international law? International law is not democratic. That is, there is no international legislature that decides what the law is. International law is customary. It's elitist. It is formed by judges, some judges appointed by governments, some by the United Nations. It is formed by scholars. In that respect, it's a little bit like Sharia or Christian law or Talmudic law. It's an elite system which becomes accepted over time through a practice. What are the criteria for deciding whether international law is appropriate? Because law is never self-defining. One of the oldest principles of Christianity is that you must make your own decisions. You render unto Caesar, to be sure, but you make your decisions as to whether law is moral, and you have to live by your own conscience and your own morality. That's true of every basic philosophy and every basic religion. I suggest there are three criteria for international law. The first and most important one is neutrality. It must be equally applicable to all parties without regard to who they are, without regard to how popular or unpopular they are. It must be neutrally and fairly applied. The second criteria is it must be predictable in advance. That is, you must be able to know, if you're an actor, how your conduct will be treated under the law. And third, it must be practical. That is, it must provide reasonable alternatives. Let me give you an example from the current disputes that are going on in the Middle East. You all were here when Israel had to go into Gaza to try to prevent rockets from hitting Sderot and killing many, many children and psychologically traumatizing others. Many in Norway and many in the international community condemned Israel for what it did, but nobody ever told Israel what it should have done. What should a country do that is having rockets directed at its children? What would Norway do? What would the citizens of Oslo demand if rockets were coming from a neighboring state? My president, Barack Obama, went to Sderot where the rockets were hitting and said, if the rockets were hitting my children's homes, I would do everything in my power to stop that, and I would expect that Israel will do the same. So the other criteria is providing reasonable alternatives to prohibited solutions. The great philosopher John Rawls, who for many years taught at Harvard and has influenced generations of philosophers today, came up with a very interesting, I would call it, gimmick for deciding whether law is valid, international law as well as domestic law. He said everybody should live under a veil of ignorance. Before you decide what the right rule should be, it's a variation of Kantian philosophy. Before you decide what a rule should be, you shouldn't know who you're going to be in the world in which the law is applied. You don't know whether you're a man or a woman, so you have to have laws that are fair to men and women. If you know you're a man, maybe the psychological inclination would be to favor men. You don't know whether you're black or white. You don't know whether you're tall or short. You don't know whether you're physically challenged or physically fit. You don't know whether you're gay or homosexual. You don't know whether you're born into Christianity or Islam or Judaism, or your parents gave you no religious training. You just don't know who you're going to be in the world, and you have to come up with a system of rules that would be fair to everybody. What a wonderful test. Now, could international law today pass that test? Let's apply several criteria of international law to some of the most contentious issues in the Middle East today. So you all know that there is a tremendous opposition in Norway and in many other places to what is called the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. By the way, that's not the way the occupation is defined in academia here in Norway. Probably many of you know about the petition that was circulated and got 191 signatures of professors at Trondheim and other universities, it talks about the occupation. Let me read you the first sentence. Since 1948, the state of Israel has occupied Palestine. This is not about 1967. This is about the very existence of the state of Israel. When I spoke last night at the university, one of the women students said, I favor the petition. And I said, are you aware the petition calls for the abolition of the state of Israel? She said, no, I thought it meant only the 1967 occupation. So when you use the word occupation, you have to be very careful. The enemies of Israel slide in a very sneaky way the word occupation into delegitimation of Israel's very right to exist. They believe that Israel's control of even one square inch of land the size of a postage stamp is an occupation and would be illegal and would be in violation of Sharia law or violation of Arab rights. But let's talk about the occupation. Is there an occupation? Start with 1948 and then go to 1967. Of course there's no occupation in 1948. In 1948, when the UN made its decision to divide that land, many, many Jews lived in what was then called Palestina from the Romans, and many Arabs lived there. Jews had a majority in some parts of the country. Arabs had a majority in other parts of the country. They didn't call themselves Palestinians then, but they called themselves local Arabs. They had a majority in other parts of the country. The United Nations, after looking at the Peel Commission, at the Balfour Declaration, at a range of other League of Nations declarations, decided the fair thing to do would be to give the Jewish state an area where it had a majority of the population, mostly along the coast. It had built Tel Aviv from scratch. There had been nothing there but sand dunes. Of course Tel Aviv was going to be a Jewish city and part of Israel. Much of the rest would be Arab. Arabs got 65% of the arable land. The Jews got 35% of the arable land. And then nobody really wanted the Negev, and the Jews insisted on getting the Negev because they thought they could rebuild it and grow, make green the sand of the Negev. That seemed like a fair resolution. That's not occupation. That's compromise. Certainly it's less severe than what happened in Czechoslovakia, where 3 million Sudeten Germans who had lived in the Czech, what is now Czechoslovakia, what the Czech Republic, what was then Czechoslovakia, had lived there for 300 years, were immediately ethnically cleansed and made to leave in the interests of peace. That was a real ethnic cleansing and occupation. What about what the Russians did in Kaliningrad, where they had no control over ever historically, but they won it in a war against the Germans, and they kicked out 2 million Germans, and they put in 1 million Russians, and now it's Russian territory. There have been many occupations, the occupation of Tibet by China, the occupation of Chechnya by Russia, the occupation of so many other areas, Kurdish areas, Armenian areas. But when you hear about the occupation with a capital T and a capital O, one thinks about only one occupation. One never hears, for example, about the Jordanian occupation of the West Bank between 1949 and 1967. One never hears about the Egyptian occupation of the Gaza Strip, a brutal, brutal occupation. It was called an open-air prison where Arabs were treated horribly by the Egyptian, by their brothers and cousins. You never hear about that as the occupation. There's only one occupation now, too, 48 to the current or 67 to the current. Let's talk about the 48 issue is really not worth talking about. It's so absurd. No country in history has ever had a more legitimate birth than Israel. Israel's birth certificate is more legal than the birth certificate of the United States, of Australia, of Canada. Those countries started simply by colonialism and occupation. Israel was formed by law, by an enactment of the League of Nations, by an enactment of the United Nations, by legislative actions in the United States, Great Britain, France, recognition by the entire world, including, of course, Norway. So its birth is not in dispute. It is a legitimate country, and among the nations of the world, has the same legitimacy as every other country in the world. So let's talk about 1967. What happened in 1967? We don't have to talk about the Gaza too much because the Gaza has, of course, been given back. What happened on the West Bank? Of course, Israel did not attack Jordan. Israel was not at war with Jordan. In fact, Israel sent a prominent Norwegian general to speak to King Hussein and to plead with King Hussein not to attack Israel. He made an incredible offer, through the Israelis made an incredible offer through the Norwegian general. If you don't attack us, we will not take one inch of land from you. We will not take the Western Wall back, even though the Western Wall is the holiest place in Judaism, has been a Jewish iconic holy place since the destruction of the temple. We will not take that back. We will not take back the Jewish quarter, which has been in Jewish hands essentially since the days of Abraham. You walk through the Jewish quarter, many of you have done so, you see the signs all around you. You see the streets, you see the excavation showing the temple period, showing the Talmudic period. You walk a little further out, you see the Via Dolorosa, you see every step that Jesus took, you see the connections between Judaism and Christianity. It's so deep and so passionate and so compelling. But Israel said, we're not taking that back because no life is worth spending even on a holy object. Israel's position. What was King Hussein's position? He quoted it to the Norwegian general. He said, my answer will come in the battlefield. He fired 1,500 rockets into downtown Jerusalem at civilians. The Israelis had no option but to respond. They did. They captured the West Bank. That was in June of 1967. You wouldn't know this if you went to a university in Norway today. But what happened in July of 1967? What happened is the Israeli government, through Moshe Dayan, made an offer to the Palestinians. The offer was, we will give you back every inch of land captured if you just make peace with us. Just give us peace and you get your land back. Peace for land, land for peace. The Arabs all went to Khartoum to have a conference. They issued their three famous no's. No peace, no recognition, no negotiation. At that point, what was Israel to do? Israel had to hold on to that land in an effort to try to negotiate peace. As Abba Ibn said in response to the Khartoum declaration, it's the first time in history that the winners in a defensive war have sued for peace and the losers have demanded unconditional surrender. Or as he put it another time, the Palestinians don't know how to take yes for an answer. They were offered the land back. They said no, no, no. The Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And this was one opportunity they missed in 1967. The opportunity didn't go away. The opportunity didn't go away. 1993, the Oslo Accords. This is the last time Oslo will ever serve, unfortunately, as a place of accord between Israel and the Arabs. There will never be another peace process in Oslo. Oslo has lost its role as a neutral arbiter between Israel and the Palestinians, unfortunately, because the Oslo Accords, I think, held enormous promise. And the Norwegian government and the Norwegian people should be very proud that it was selected as a place where Nobel Prizes could be won in Oslo, not only presented in Oslo, but won in Oslo, and several Nobel Prizes were won because of the Oslo Accords. A very, very proud and potentially constructive moment, but nothing really came of it. Why? Because building on the Oslo Accords, President Clinton and Ehud Barak offered the Palestinians everything they had ever dreamed for in 2000-2001, 100% of the Gaza, 95 to 97% of the West Bank, and in exchange for the 3 to 5% land in other areas of the country to make up for it, to compensate for the fact that Israel had in fact built neighborhoods that could not be torn down in Maale Adumim and Gilo and other areas right outside of Jerusalem. They offered a divided Jerusalem. You know how painful that was? It's like cutting out your own heart. Jerusalem, the heart and soul of the Jewish people. I grew up as an Orthodox Jew. Three times a day I prayed to return to Jerusalem. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, if I forget Jerusalem, may my tongue cleave to my mouth. May my right hand lose its cunning. The two things Jews pray for more than anything else is Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, and Shalom, peace, peace. That's all you hear. You go to a synagogue, every word, if you only know two words in Hebrew, Yerushalayim and Shalom, you can sit in a synagogue on a Friday night, a Saturday, a Jewish holiday, and you will hear over and over again, Shalom, Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, Shalom. And yet Israel was prepared, in the interests of Shalom, peace, to give up parts of its heritage in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem. and yet the Palestinians turned it down. The Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia shook his finger at Arafat and said to him, if you turn down this offer, you are committing a crime against the Palestinian people. And Yasser Arafat committed that crime against the Palestinian people. Then he compounded it because he went back to his bunker and called for an intifada. And the intifada resulted in 5,000 unnecessary deaths. 1,000 Israelis were killed, babies, children, people going to pizza parlors, adults, emigres from Russia who were dancing in the Dolphinarium on a weekend night, blown to pieces, and 4,000 Palestinians were killed. It was a terrible, terrible tragedy. The blood of those victims are on the hands of Yasser Arafat and on the hands of those who turned down the peace offer in 2000 and 2001. And then it was repeated. Ehud Olmert offered in 2007 and 2008 virtually the same thing, and the Palestinians again walked away. Why do the Palestinians walk away from these deals? I can give you an answer in one word. Norway. Norway is the reason the Palestinians walk away from deals that require them to compromise. Why? Because Norway has told the Palestinians very simply, you don't have to compromise. You don't have to do anything. We will recognize the PLO. We will give you ambassadorial status. We'll recognize your state. We'll give you everything you want. You don't have to give Israel anything. You don't have to negotiate. We will give you what you want without you doing anything in return. Norway, that's the problem. The problem is governments who are prepared to tell the Palestinians, we will demand everything of Israel, we'll boycott them if they don't do what we want, but of you, the Palestinians, we demand nothing. You just sit still, we'll give you what you want, as if you're the only country ever occupied. What's the difference between the occupation of the West Bank and the occupation of China, the occupation of Tibet by China, the occupation of Chechnya? There are several differences. One, the Palestinians have gotten attention through terrorism. The Chechens and the Tibetans, for the most part, have not. Two, the Palestinians have allies who have oil, and their enemy is Israel. Their perceived enemy is Israel. And the other third difference is Israel has offered to end the occupation. None of these other countries have. Has China ever made an offer to Tibet? Has Russia ever made an offer to Chechnya? No. The Palestinians are sitting on an offer right now. Just this week, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said to the Palestinians on a CNN interview with Piers Morgan, come to Jerusalem, invite me to Ramallah, unconditionally. Let's negotiate. You will get the land. You will get 90-something percent, and we will give you the others in return. We'll have to negotiate hard about Jerusalem. We'll have to negotiate hard about some rights of return or refugee status. But at the borders, we can figure them out. Come and negotiate. And the Palestinians won't sit down to negotiate to get their land. Who ever heard of that? I'm a lawyer. I negotiate all the time. And when I negotiate, I don't say I'm refusing to sit down. When I want a position, when I want something, when you want something, you sit down and negotiate. You don't impose preconditions for negotiation. So is Israel in compliance or out of compliance with Resolution 242 of the UN? You read that, you hear about that, all the questions I was asked at the universities, 242, 242. I know a little bit about Resolution 242. I was there when it was drafted. I was Arthur Goldberg's law clerk when he was on the Supreme Court. He called me to the Waldorf Astoria during the negotiations for 242 and asked me to help him with the draftsmanship and the wording. I know what happened. I know the debates that occurred. And the end result of the 242 debate was that Britain and the United States insisted that the word territories be put in 242, not the territories, not all the territories. In other words, they adopted essentially what was then called the Alon Plan. Israel would be permitted to make small territorial changes to avoid what had been called the Auschwitz borders, the borders that would assure the death of Jews, and that would be part of it. And this was the most important thing that people who talk about 242 without reading it don't understand. There are mutual obligations under 242. Israel is supposed to return territories captured, but only when the Arab states in the area recognize its right to live in peace. Without recognition and peace, There is no obligation to return one dunam of land. There are no unilateral obligations.